Good afternoon. May it please the court, Andrew Hare on behalf of Adam Zamora. I'm the Deputy State Public Defender. My registration number is 16891. The crux of this case really is about notice under the Sixth Amendment and Article 2, Section 16 of the Colorado Constitution. A defendant's right to be aware of the nature and cause of the accusation. So I wanted to start a little bit about, because there's a dispute obviously over what Mr. Zamora and his lawyers were aware of, informed about with respect to the charges in this case, specifically the felony murder conviction and the two aggravated robbery convictions. And so I wanted to kind of set the landscape with respect to what was Mr. Zamora and his lawyers aware of. The felony murder count alleged in the language of the felony murder statute, the elements of felony murder, and set forth the predicate as robbery. Two succeeding counts alleged aggravated robbery. The aggravated nature is not really necessarily relevant. One was the resisted one maims or injures. The second one was, generally speaking, the traditional aggravated robbery involving use of a deadly weapon. What was uniform in those two particular counts, and what's uniform really in the robbery that's referenced in the felony murder count, is a necessary element to all robberies, and that is the taking of a thing of value. In the two aggravated robbery counts, the counts referred to and said specifically, namely, U.S. currency. And that's what notified Mr. Zamora and his lawyers what he was accused of with respect to the taking and the robbery that they were alleged had occurred during the event in question. The robbery in this case, there's only one robbery. The aggravated robbery and the robbery and the felony murder are all one. It's one and the same. The state below essentially conceded that when he asserted that they merge after conviction. And there is only one uniform element of taking, and the one taking that they alleged at the outset of this case was U.S. currency. Some things that occurred before trial that would have led counsel to believe correctly that this is what their client was charged with and that the client would make decisions thereon. For example, when the state moved to join the two defendants, Mr. Zamora's brother, Aaron, in that particular motion, the state alleged that factually, Mr. Zamora, my client, Adam Zamora, had shot and killed Mr. Newman while he was robbing him of his money. There was no mention of a knife. Secondly, the defense moved or notified the prosecution that we were exercising the right of self-defense. They're aware that this interaction between Mr. Newman, who had the knife, and Mr. Zamora, who had a handgun, was at issue. And so the nature of this particular item and what happened to it was essential in this particular case. At the beginning of this trial, the trial court instructed the jury on the charges, told the jury what the charges were, and those charges were read as I just described. Aaron Zamora, on the other hand, he was charged differently in his aggravated robbery counts. In his aggravated robbery counts, they alleged both the U.S. currency and the knife. So not only does counsel now know as they're approaching and starting trial that their client is charged with just taking the U.S. currency, they also know that they're not charged with taking a knife, and that that's a distinction with a difference.
Well, can you address that, Mr. Hare? And I'll just say the issue that concerns me, I understand your arguments about the fairness of it, and I have some concerns about that. But could you address the prejudice here? What would have been different? You say, we tried the case a certain way. Your client took the stand, and I don't think there was any dispute. I had the knife or whatever else. So what would have been different? I mean, my concern is to find prejudice here. We don't always have to assume that he would have testified, would have perjured himself. We assume he would have testified the same, I guess.
I understand exactly what you're saying.
What would have changed? What would you have done differently?
Well, this gets into the kind of the analysis under simple variance, which allows the court to consider the surrounding circumstances. Rice is an example to get into what actually happened here. So what we do know, and the court can look to the verdicts in the case, that's what they did in Rice, that's what they do in typical joinder cases, whether it's a joinder of offenses or joinder of defendants, the court will often look to what happens with verdicts to decide whether or not joinder of cases or defendants as prejudice. Here, the changing and inclusion now of the knife, we know, I believe, that's not necessarily relevant, but looking at the record in these verdicts, there's no question but that the jury completely utterly rejected the notion that these two young men took the U.S. currency. They don't buy it. They're not buying it. Aaron Zamora is acquitted of all counts except for reckless manslaughter. My client's acquitted of conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery, which was the gist of this entire case, that there was a conspiracy to rob this young man. So the prejudice is that the lawyers have prepared in the context of self-defense that he has taken this knife justifiably, legally, in defense of his life, in defense of his person. Prejudices his defense because now, as I've described in argument three, the nature and timing of this taking, and argument two as well, the nature of the timing of this particular taking becomes very much in play. Argument two is plain error, but it's plain error in part because these lawyers were basically hamstrung at the time that this particular amendment takes place. Very likely there would have been a different kind of approach to describing the taking, cross-examination. Skidmore and Jeffries and Jefferson talk about the defense is powerless to rebut this, powerless to cross-examine and further explore what was the nature of the taking, how did it come into play, and how does one craft instructions to address this particular issue.
Well, wasn't the amendment allowed before the instructions were given?
It was after the instructions had been discussed by counsel.
So Mr. Zamora could have asked, in light of the amendment, he could have submitted new instructions.
Well, he submitted an instruction that asked an interrogatory that the jury be required to decide between the knife and the U.S. currency.
Okay, so he responded to the amendment by changing his strategy vis-a-vis the instructions.
I will say they made some effort toward that end. They did not see all of the issues as I described in arguments two and three. They are plain error. I don't dispute that. But in terms of analysis, Mr. Zamora, additional prejudice, is led to believe that this knife is not in the equation within the narrative of potential culpability. So at the time that he is given curse advice, and at the time his lawyers advise him about what he should and shouldn't say, how he should marshal his defense, he is not told that he is unwittingly convicting himself of each of the offenses in this particular case. I mean, that's the epitome of prejudice. Now, whether he makes that decision knowing that, we don't know. But he has unknowingly, involuntarily made a decision to testify when he's been misled to believe that the knife is not part of the narrative of potential culpability.
Was there evidence admitted prior to his testifying that he had taken the knife?
There was evidence, certainly the prosecution witnesses, the prosecution's theory was that Aaron Zamora had taken a knife. There basically was one witness who offered testimony that he believed that Aaron Zamora took the knife. There were others who were unsure about it. There was evidence that the knife turned up in, Adam Zamora's girlfriend's car in her apartment, that kind of thing. So there was some evidence. The prosecution was aware of it during their case in chief. They did not move to amend. Didn't move to amend at that time, didn't move to amend it at halftime, did not move to amend until after Mr. Zamora testified. If I can address...
How exactly is this case different from Al Yusuf, if I've got the name right, where the indictment charged theft of three or four items and it was amended then to add three or four different items?
That was before trial. And as the substance reform under 7E, you can do it before trial. And that's, I believe, explicitly in the opinion.
But didn't the division hold that it was a matter of form, not substance?
Under those circumstances.
Well, they didn't qualify by the circumstances. They just said it's a matter of form, correct?
Under that charge and under those circumstances, Your Honor, I believe that would be true. But under these circumstances, given the landscape under which this particular amendment took place and the importance, the critical nature of it, with respect to both his decision to testify in terms of the nature of his defense, in terms of the nature of the ability to cross-examine and rebut any notions that the taking of this knife was somehow culpable at all.
In objecting to the request to amend, did Mr. Zamora's trial counsel argue that essentially the Arguello advisement was defective because he made his decision to testify under different circumstances. Was that specifically argued?
That specific reference was not made. However, there was explicit reference made to his ability to prepare and present a defense, which of course includes his ability to testify. And
but there was no specific reference to his decision to testify having been tainted by the amendment.
In terms of taint, I believe it was referenced to the fact that, that they presented their defense, which necessarily included a design. And keeping in mind, whether they reference the fact that he has testified or not, in fact, that he did testify, counsel referenced both the Colorado United States Constitution, his right to a fair trial, his right to present a defense, that it had impaired and hamstrung their defense in light of this amendment. So understanding where these lawyers are, it's beyond the 11th hour. I mean, they're past jury instructions when this is happening, and they are objecting to, properly so, under the Constitution's and referencing his right to present a defense. That is sufficient to satisfy reference to the nature of what's happening in this particular case in his defense, which included his testimony.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can just clarify, I know you want to move on to something else. So, assuming this was an amendment as to form, your argument would be it's prejudicial because basically he was surprised, and going back to where I started, your argument for prejudice, he may not have testified. He may have chosen not to give the, basically concede the conviction. And I mean, is there other prejudice besides that? I haven't heard he would have testified differently, the evidence would have been different, but maybe he wouldn't have testified at all.
Well, it's not only that. I think Basala-Hernandez presents somewhat of a decent bit, as does Rice. Rice involves a defendant who testifies, and then the argument is expanded. The court talks about an expansion or broader scope of the potential liability of the particular defendant in that case. Basala-Hernandez, the prosecution was allowed, as here, to reference and include in within the context of the charge defense conduct that occurred after the actual charge, that is to say, It was a intoxication defense with specific intent, and the prosecution was permitted to, over objection, to reference argument conduct of the defendant that was at a time when he clearly was sober. So we're talking about a prejudice that results in conviction because the prosecution here, different than they had argued in opening, which was that Aaron Zamora had taken the knife, which was consistent with their charge, now changes it and shifts it over to, and actually specifically utilizes this testimony that would not have been possible had this amendment not taken place. So the conviction itself is resting firmly upon, as I said, looking at the verdicts in this particular case, resting firmly upon the fact that my client unwittingly is convicting himself by referencing this knife and how he took it and the circumstances under which he took it. I see my time. I have about 2 minutes. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for the
Run the podium back down, if you wish.
Well, I'm very comfortable. I realize that opposing counsel is a good bit taller than I am, but I kind of like having my notes under my chin. Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Borova. I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. It's certainly the people's position that the defendant's contention is moot because, I perhaps should use a moot microphone, the defendant's conviction is moot because the counts were merged with the felony murder conviction, although they were not predicates for it. And this is an important distinction because the two counts of aggravated robbery did in fact charge that the defendant had taken the U.S. currency, but there was no indication that simple robbery was so charged, which was the predicate crime for the felony murder.
Doesn't the predicate crime have to be separately charged?
Your Honor, I believe it was charged.
No, the point is that the robbery, aggravated robbery, was separately charged, but the predicate crime for the felony murder here was simple robbery.
Correct.
And I think Judge Webb's question is, do you have to charge simple robbery separately?
Well, I think you have to charge within the felony murder the underlying crime, which was here robbery.
But there doesn't have to be a separate count.
And I don't remember if there was a separate count, because I don't have the charging documents.
There was no separate count of simple robbery.
Okay. Well, I don't think that makes the aggravated robbery necessarily the predicate count, because, of course, to prove the predicate count, the jury separately instructed on the elements of that crime. So I hadn't thought about this before, but I'm not sure that a predicate count has to be charged separately.
Well, it would have to be charged separately, because that's the only way to get a verdict on it.
You get the verdict on it by the felony murder conviction, because within the felony murder conviction, and I do have the jury instructions with me, the jury's instructed on the elements of simple robbery.
Okay.
So I think there clearly is a verdict with regard to the count of simple robbery, whether or not it was separately charged.
So the people could charge simply murder one, felony murder, no other charges, and be able to obtain that conviction if they plead the predicate charge within the murder charge.
I believe that's so. I think, as a rule, the people generally prefer to do separate charges, lest the jury not decide that it is, in fact, felony murder.
Right.
So I think that does happen as a matter of course, but I'm not sure it's absolutely necessary.
I'm sorry, Ms. Robart, while we're on this. As I expressed to Mr. Hare, I do have some concerns about what really is an 11th hour amendment. And I recognize, I guess what I'm going to is, I'm cutting the lawyer too thin to say, the fact that they amended the aggravated robbery charge to add the knife had no impact on the robbery, doesn't matter at all. That's troubling to me. What, isn't that the notice? The question is, was the defendant being, were the evidence different for the aggravated robbery and the robbery charge in terms of what was taken? Wasn't the defendant basically notified we're talking about taking money and not taking a knife?
Well, it's clear that the brother, Aaron Zamora, the aggravated robbery charges also said knife and U.S. currency. So the prosecution's position was that they discovered at the 11th hour that they had not included the knife. But it was clear all along, and of course I don't have the records of discovery, but that the knife was one of the items that was taken, the knife and the envelope of money. And with regard to how the various witnesses testified, it's my memory that one of the witnesses testified that one of the brothers took the knife, he wasn't sure which one. Another witness, and I believe it was DePaul, said that in fact it was the defendant who had taken both the money and the knife. So I'm not sure that it was clear at trial necessarily that Aaron had taken the knife, and certainly with his testimony that it might have been one brother or the other. Now, of course, the brothers were charged also as co-conspirators, and the jury was given a complicity instruction. So, arguably, it didn't actually matter which brother took the knife as long as something of value was taken. And when we look at whether it's a form or a substance, a substantive defect in the information is one which changes the crime charged. And the trial court was very clear here that the same crime was charged, the same crime of aggravated robbery. And what's necessary is to take anything of value. And one of the things the trial court said at the time is, we don't need to change the jury instructions because the jury instructions already say anything of value. It's not my memory that the defense requested additional jury instructions at that time, but the crime is definitely to take anything of value, and the knife is a thing of value.
Well, let's assume that's right. So we have just a simple variance here.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a strong argument on that point, frankly. Why isn't the defendant here, Mr. Zamora, prejudiced? When he takes the stand, he basically concedes he took the knife. Now you've made your case. He don't know that the knife's an issue until after he testifies. Why isn't that prejudicial?
Well, there are two reasons that it's not prejudicial. The first reason is that there's clearly already plentiful evidence that he did take the knife. The knife came away from the crime scene in the defendant's girlfriend's car.
Didn't the brother also ride in the car?
Well, the brother did ride in the car. Again, as I said, they're complicitors. So I'm not sure when push comes to shove if it makes a difference which brother took the knife, but clearly it came away from the scene with the defendant in the girlfriend's car. The girlfriend's friend later turned the knife over to the police, and it was identified at trial as the victim's knife. So it came away from the scene with the brothers, and also we have the testimony of these other witnesses. Again, someone who said one of the brothers, I don't know which one took it, the other one said that the defendant took it. But it's clear all along that the knife is among those items, just as in the Aliyev-Seth case, that the knife is among those items that left the scene with the brothers. So I think there's no prejudice in that way, because I think he's not... It's cumulative to a lot of evidence that's already been presented.
But it's based on the... let's take complicity out for a minute. I do understand your argument about that. If there's no complicity issue, as I understand you, the evidence... There was mixed evidence on who took the knife. And so that may well get you there on sufficiency, but isn't it very helpful to you when the defendant himself takes a stand and says, I took the knife? That's what's troubling to me. The evidence you've said so far, again, take complicity out, is that some witnesses said Aaron took it, some said Adam took it. We've got a mixed bag. A jury could find reasonable doubt on who took the knife based on that. But then Adam takes the stand and says, I took the knife. I'm concerned about that.
Well, I think it's also important to look at the context of Adam Zamora's testimony. Adam had to testify in order to claim self-defense, because the other witnesses testified either that the victim did not take his knife out of his pocket, or that he took his knife out of his pocket only in response to the defendant pointing the gun at him and defending and demanding his money. So in order to be entitled to a self-defense instruction, which was specific essentially to Adam Zamora, because he was the one who was charged with intentional murder, the defendant had to testify concerning his version of the events. And as you stated in the questioning of opposing counsel, we can't assume that he would have testified falsely and perjured himself. And certainly, since he's on the stand, he can then be asked, and did you take the knife away from the scene, or what happened to the knife? So I think that's clearly fair game once he's made the decision to testify, and I don't think the decision to testify can hang only on what was taken from the scene, because I think in terms of self-defense, there was a really important reason for him to testify so we get the self-defense instructions. So, again, I don't think that the defendant was prejudiced. I think that it was clear to the defense all along. And in denying the motion for new trial, the trial court was very clear that the trial court did not feel that the defense was valid, that it would have been a valid defense to say, oh, I didn't take the thing of value you charged me with, but I took another thing of value. He said that that would be an incorrect statement of the law, because the law requires taking a thing of value. And when we look, again, it's my position that this contention is moot, but when we look at the standard of review being abuse of discretion, I think that the record fully supports the trial court's decision to permit the amendment here. My light has just flipped to 5 minutes, and I've reviewed my notes, and I don't think I have further points that I need to make to this court beyond what I said in the brief. Does this court have further questions for me?
Apparently not.
All right. I ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction.
May it please the court, with respect to the issue of complicity, I think the state is referencing another layer of prejudice. My client, not charged with taking the knife initially, he can't be complicit in taking the knife if he's not charged with it. You can't be a complicit to a crime you're not charged with. So in this sense, this is yet another example of the amendment allowing conviction based upon a theory of complicity that was not otherwise present. That is to say, upon the conduct and behavior of his brother. They were not on notice of that. In fact, they were specifically on notice that he was not again, it was not within the narrative of potential culpability.
So it's your position that in order to have a felony one conviction, the premise violation, the felony that's premised has to be, has to be separately charged?
Well, it has to be, the defendant has the right to notice. So, for example, in Palmer, there's a felony murder count, burglary is the predicate, there's a succeeding burglary count, which set forth the elements of burglary and the ulterior offense. The defendant asserted that he didn't have notice and it was jurisdictionally defective with respect to felony murder because it just said burglary. This court said no, this the felony murder, that this particular issue was sufficient to give notice to the defendant because the succeeding burglary count itemized the elements of burglary and the ulterior offense, and the court finished by saying, therefore, the defendant has notice of all of the elements comprised within the context of felony murder. So in some fashion, whether it's in the context of the felony murder count, you have to itemize what the elements are so you know what the elements of the robbery are and what you took, or you have to have succeeding the offenses in succeeding counts upon which you can be granted, given accurate notice about what you're accused of doing.
Mr. Ayer, you only got about 10 seconds. Could you respond to Ms. Rohrbar's argument about that your client had to testify because he was raising self-defense?
Well, again, this is yet another example of the prejudice, because Mr. Zamora gave notice to the prosecution long before trial that he was going to raise self-defense. Ms. Rohrbar says, well, he knew he had to testify. So they're baiting him into testifying. They know that he has to get on the stand to marshal this evidence because the prosecution witnesses were very varied, and obviously the jury didn't believe much of what they said, and for good reason, but they were all over the board. But again, this is yet another example that in order to marshal this defense, the prosecution knew, and he notified them that he was going to raise the defense of self-defense, that he had to testify. If they knew that, and they knew this was so important, that all of the evidence, that all the witnesses that everyone talked about said that this knife was out there, and it didn't matter that he's complicit, that he may have had it, he may have didn't have it, they still didn't give notice. That's called laying in the weeds. So when Mr. Jensen, at the end of the trial, says, I made a mistake, a 30-year prosecutor did not make a mistake. He did not make a mistake in this case. So if the court has no further questions, I ask the court to reverse the convictions.
Thank you. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.